just on 10 to 5. And I realise that we're standing between you guys and the end of the day. My name's Gillian Harricks. I'm chairing this session. You're here to... Whoa, got to not see that. No. So, yes, we're here for the ACT and ACC scheme updates. We're going to hear, first of all, from Lisa Holmes, who's the Director of Financial Framework Management and Insurance with the ACT Chief Minister. And her responsibilities include the regulation and administration of the ACT CTP scheme, amongst many other things. She currently has particular responsibility for the citizens' jury, which I'm sure we're all looking forward to hearing about. Lisa came into her role in 2015 and is currently acting as the CTP regulator because Karen Doran is off doing other things at the moment. And she's also the acting Lifetime Care and Support Commissioner for the ACT, where they have a small number of participants in their lifetime scheme. So Lisa's going to talk first for 15 or 20 minutes. If we've got time, we'll take a couple of questions before we hear from Dominic. Otherwise, we might leave questions to the end. Thanks.
In August of this year, the ACT government announced it was going to do a deliberative democracy process for CTP. And when I got that news, I think the expression on my face was fairly priceless. It's like, what on earth is deliberative democracy? Because I don't have a clue. So I thought that would be the first thing I'd share with you. So deliberative democracy, you know, it's an engagement model. It is different from traditional engagement. Traditionally, you know, when you go out and you do consultation, you get a whole heap of different views, and then it all comes back to the government and they sort of scratch their heads and try and have to reconcile a whole heap of different perspectives and decide which way they go forward. And people who are sometimes providing that feedback don't necessarily have all the information, so that influences the feedback that you get from them. In comparison, a deliberative democracy process, you bring participants together, you give them all the relevant information, you give them time to think about that and to deliberate, and they reach a shared view as to what's the way forward. So rather than government having to pull all these different views together, this type of process does that for you. So I'm sure a number of you might immediately be thinking, okay, yes, there's definitely some positives for this type of process. So why did we decide to do it for the CTP scheme? Firstly, you know, the government considered that, you know, our CTP scheme could be improved. You know, we have the second highest premiums of CTP in Australia. We have an at-fault system, which is pure common law, essentially. So, you know, we saw a lot of things that we could improve. But we wanted to hear what the community said about it. And the problem is that often you find the community, particularly in CTP, doesn't have an active voice on the issue. So you might have some very strong stakeholder groups who you hear loud and clear, but it's hard to hear the voice, in this case, of the motorist who actually pays the premiums and, if it's injured, actually is getting the benefits from the scheme. We also knew from a survey that we'd done a little while ago that the community actually didn't have a good understanding of the scheme. So if you're trying to do traditional consultation methods, the feedback that you were going to get was going to be influenced from a basis of not understanding what they had in the first place. And lastly, there's no right or wrong answer when it comes to CTP. It's often a value judgment, and people need to trade off and weigh up. So we thought all of those things lent itself quite well to a deliberative democracy process. So we brought in an expert who does this type of work in terms of coming up with a strategy, which actually would work for this particular topic. So, you know, there are a lot of different types of deliberative democracy processes. A citizens' jury is just one, and you really do need to cater your process to the specifics of your topic and what you're trying to achieve and the type of stakeholder groups that you've got involved in that issue. As well as having a citizens' jury of about 50 jurors, the other key element of the strategy was to have a stakeholder reference group. And that means that you're still allowing those stakeholders to have a key say and an influence in the process, but you're managing the amount of input that they can have, and it means that they're not the only voice that you're hearing. You can hear other voices in this arena. So the stakeholder reference group was quite critical in terms of the strategy, this particular strategy. And the stakeholder reference group, as you can imagine, you know, we've got the insurers, we've got the legal profession. We thought it was important that the health element was also in that stakeholder reference group. And you've all heard this morning from, you know, a lot of people talking about the research as to how beneficial from a health perspective, it is to have early intervention. So we thought that that element was important in the stakeholder reference group. We also have, of course, you know, an actuary and scheme design expert. So in terms of what is the actual strategy itself, so stage one is for the jury to consider the question, what should be the objectives of an improved CTP scheme to best balance the interests of all road users? Now, in coming up with those objectives, there's no template, there's no particular questions, that's it. They have a blank piece of paper to come up with whatever objectives they want to set that they think, you know, is the right objectives for the scheme. Once those objectives are set, it goes to the stakeholder reference group to actually develop up to four models which meets those objectives. And, you know, this is taking into consideration when the strategy was come up, you know, that sort of work is technical work. That would be hard for a jury to do. So it made sense for the technical people, the stakeholder reference group, to come up with those models. So that's how, you know, the strategy was tailored to suit the particular topic. Those four models then goes back to the jury, and the jury will then decide on what their preferred model is. The government did say that there were just some things in this process that it just was not going to consider. So we had to take them off the table in the first place. So there are limits to what the jury could consider. Probably the key one is that premiums couldn't rise as a result of this process. But they also had a couple of others, as you'd expect, that CTP has to remain compulsory. They've said that our scheme had to remain privately underwritten. It had to remain community rated, and it couldn't broaden in terms of the type of vehicles that it was covered. So, you know, the bicycle who runs down someone who's walking and injures them, you know, they're currently outside the CTP scheme. That type of thing couldn't be brought in as a result of this process. So how do you select a jury in this process? It's totally random. It's one of the scary things when it comes to this whole process is, as a bureaucrat, you know, used to having controls, that it's totally random. This whole process is outside of your control. So 6,000 invitations were randomly sent out by Australia Post. 1,500 online invitations went out through Vote Compass. If you received one of those invitations, you could then choose whether or not you were interested in participating. And if so, then you'd advise an external company that you're interested in being part of the jury. You could not be part of the jury if you had, if you were participating. So if you were a plaintiff lawyer, if you were an insurer, if you were a CTP policy officer, you couldn't be part of the jury because you want a jury which is balanced and doesn't unduly influence the jury by particularly trying to push a point of view. It's important that the jury hears those point of views, but you have to balance how that actually feeds into the process. So we had 117 people say yes, they were prepared to be on the jury. From that, there was another random process where 50 were then selected to best represent the demographics of the ACT. So this is all about this jury is representative of the rest of the community for the ACT. So that's what the jury is really representing at the end of the day. So what does the actual process look like? So stage one, we've had four very intense days, I have to say, two full weekends, starting at 8:30 in the morning and going through to, you know, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. They first learnt about, you know, what is CTP, some of the basics of CTP. Really importantly, they learned critical thinking skills. So when they got the information then for the rest of the 4 days, they had their set of questions to ask. Things like, do you make a profit from doing this? So, you know, they were really testing the point of view and the perspectives that people might be putting to them, shall I say, and asking those sorts of questions. You know, is it based on data? Is it based on fact? You know, can you really back up what you're saying? Can you substantiate it? And that, as I said, that was really a powerful thing, and you saw that then for the next 3 days. There were traditional mechanisms which we used from consultation, which all fed into the jury. So the jury had the ability then of knowing what the wider community was, but knowing that, you know, what they were getting in terms of information and time to think about it was always going to be much better than someone who's asked a question in a survey. The stakeholders, the insurers, the legal profession did get time to actually sit down with the jurors in small groups to put their perspective forward, and the jury had time to question them. There were 16 witnesses which they heard from and they workshopped with. The stakeholder reference group put forward a list of potential witnesses to the jury, but the jury actually picked who they wanted to hear from. So, you know, what do they want to hear about? Who do they trust to tell them that information? And they did hear from injured people as well. So they heard stories from 3 people who had had a successful claim and 3 who didn't have or didn't have a CTP claim at all. And those stories were really powerful. Now, I mentioned the survey and some of the traditional methods which actually did feed into the process. I thought I'd just quickly flick through some of the findings of the telephone survey. It had a margin of error of 4.4%, so very very sound survey. And because we knew that there was some misunderstandings out there, we tried to ask questions which were value questions as much as possible so that people didn't have to have a lot of information to be answered questions. So one, there was some which had really strong results. So in relation to the question as to who should get coverage, 72% said everyone should get something. In relation to the question of how benefits were determined, 55% said it should be paid based on some set model of benefits rather than going to court. In relation to whether or not people who had less serious injuries should have their compensation fixed in some way, 79% said yes. 55% said that people with more serious injuries should get compensation for the non-financial loss. So hence, you know, who people who have less serious injuries shouldn't. This one's quite an interesting one, and it's within the margin of error. So if they're asked the question, would you prefer to pay more premiums and get a more generous scheme versus less premiums, less generous, it was pretty much line ball. So that was an interesting one. And the last one is they were actually asked about a number of scheme features and they were asked to rate the importance of it. The top two was actually 83% about compensation being paid quickly, and the next one was actually about affordability of insurance premiums. And as I said, there was a lot of other feedback which went into them. Although, you know, there was the opportunity for feedback, but it was self-select. And the jurors did know that when they were assessing the weight of the evidence which was going into them. Now, rather than giving my reflections on the first 4 days, I think I'd let you hear directly from the jurors and the SIG members.
Hi, welcome to Canberra's First Citizen Jury. I'm one of the jurors.
I'm very interested in the citizen engagement involved in this process.
I really love Canberra and I would love to see the ACT have a scheme which is really good and equitable and so on, and that if I can have something to do with bringing that about, that's exciting. Mm.
In 2 days, they're up with some of the policy people I've worked with.
I'd say the voracious appetite for knowledge and information.
And I agree. And some really good questions from the jury. Much better than I expected.
I think there are different levels of knowledge. And what surprised me most is that they've gone at it very quickly. They've got into the subject quite quickly, you know, immediately engaging. So I am concerned that there are such different levels of knowledge, and I'm not sure that we're addressing that properly. But apart from that, that's what's surprising. But it is. I mean, which it's going.
But it is. It's a very interesting point because I feel like people are coming along the journey at quite a rapid pace as well, which again is interesting in such a sort of fast paced process.
It's quite interesting actually. There's an element of fun as well that's going on. So I think that just shows that people are being truly open in getting some different ideas and different perspectives.
They talk about the citizens' jury being a collective mind, and I've really seen that come to life. Like they're really working together really well and really considering and respecting their other jurors. So.
I see this as very much as a community-based input into actual decision-making at a government level. And in that sense, if it contributes in whatever small way, in a positive way, then I think that's... I would feel very satisfied that there are some ways in which we can add to what we've, or what generations before me have fought for.
It's interesting. The jurors have now delivered their report on the objectives. It's 18 pages that they wrote themselves. So we don't touch a word of it. It's they sit there on Google Docs and they do it on the last day, and the ownership that they have of that document when you actually hear them is quite amazing. So what have they actually identified? They've come up with six objectives. The first one, 84% of the jury assessed to have be at least an 8 out of 10 in terms of priority, and that's early access to medical treatment, economic support and rehabilitation services. So the information they got about, the medical helping when it comes to, you know, that early intervention and your outcomes really resonated with them. The next one, equitable cover for all people injured in a motor vehicle accident, 82% assess that as 8 out of 10 or higher in terms of priority. So everyone, regardless of who was at fault, gets something. They talk about statutory provisions to apply for all accidents deemed to be minor or non-serious, but they have said that they do want some common law still for serious injuries. Value for money and an efficient system. They did not say what they wanted premiums to do, so they've been totally silent on that point. What they have said is that they want this scheme to be streamlined, they want it to be efficient, they want transparency in relation to things such as legal costs and insurer profits, and they want a dispute resolution system that has early resolution of complaints. They've acknowledged, you know, better to not have accidents in the first place, you know, better not to have people needing a CTP scheme. But they also want broader information about people and what they've actually got their coverage for with CTP, and that's going back to people not understanding the scheme at the moment. Resonated with a lot of them, they wanted some sort of support system. They said, you know, we don't have a clue usually, and a lot of people don't, as to if they've got an accident, how to actually access the scheme. And they want that type of system in place, and they think that that should not be provided by anyone who has a financial stake. So they basically said, lawyers, yes, you do have a part to play in the scheme, but you shouldn't have to go to a lawyer because, you know, you don't understand how to navigate the scheme. And we did have the detective from the New South Wales Fraud Task Force talk to them, and hence, I think, you know, as you can see, that had a resonation with them, and that last one about a system that strengthens integrity, reduces fraudulent behaviour. So we're now at the process of actually coming up with four models and having them costed, given that premiums can't increase, and then it'll go back in March to the jury to decide which one is their preferred model. And I wanted to end on this point. Deliberative democracy processes are all about trust. It's the government trusting in the community in order to be able to deliberate and make informed decisions, rather than saying, oh, no, they can't do that, that's too hard. If you talk to anyone who's done one of these processes, they say, you know, the community will surprise you every single time in terms of their thinking and what they ultimately come up with. And it's about the community trusting in the government to listen to them and act on what they want. And the authority that the government has given is very, very strong. You know, it's leveraging off that, and it's leveraging off the fact that the models are being designed by the stakeholder reference group. So the government has committed to pursuing the jury's preferred model. And also, I should just say, there's a whole heap of documents on the website, including the 18-page report from the jury, if anyone's interested, as well as all the presentations and things, and the survey that I mentioned, which went to the jury.
Thanks, Lisa. I think that was probably one of the most interesting updates we've had in a really long time. We've probably got time for one or two quick questions of Lisa before we move on. Dominic's given me his OK to do that. Andrew.
Andrew Fox, retired regulator. I was interested about the four models that are going to be presented by the reference group. Does the government have any say whether they like them or don't like them to influence the design of the four before it goes to the jury? So I guess what's behind my question is there any government bias into the design of the four that they're all acceptable by the government, therefore the government can accept them? Or does the stakeholder reference group have unfettered discretion?
So there are two government members on the stakeholder reference group of 10. I am one representing the CTB regulator. We have someone from our Courts and Justice Directorate as the other member. So, you know, we don't have majority. The government does not have to approve or agree. In fact, these models won't go to the government in any shape or form. So basically, as I said, you know, this is about trust in a very big way. And we had a lot of conversations with the government about this particular authority. They've essentially said anything has to be an improvement over what we've got now. We've got a minority, so they rule with the Green Party. They like the idea of deliberative democracy. It was in the agreement when this particular government came in. A number of other jurisdictions, South Australia in particular, have done a fair amount in this space. So that the comms people were doing a strategy around deliberative democracy and how we might introduce that into the ACT at the same time as, you know, there was conversations about CTP and the ACT. And the government said, well, great, let's do a pilot on deliberative democracy for CTP.
How did you pay the people coming along on their weekends?
They get an honorarium, so they get $75 a day. So it's not really pay, it's a case of, you know, covering things like petrol, babysitting, all that sort of stuff that they might want to do. So, and as I said, they're all amazing and they're all absolutely passionate about being on the jury.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. I think we'll look forward to seeing what comes out of that. We're going to move from the ACT to New Zealand now. I'll sort that out in a minute. Dominic Drummond is going to be presenting on the ACC. So Dominic's a corporate governance specialist in the public sector and he's worked closely with boards and senior management to promote ethical decision-making and safeguard financial integrity. To ensure that the ACC in New Zealand is protecting itself from fraud, waste and abuse, his team has been using data insights to identify early indicators. They've got a really strong focus on prevention and contributing to business integrity, and Dominic's going to share some of those risks and opportunities that they've been facing in laying the foundation for the future. Thanks.
All right. Thanks very much, guys, for sticking around. I appreciate that you're either in here because Lisa's had a fascinating conversation around democracy, or equally likely, you're really excited to hear how the New Zealand ACC is using data to better transform, prevent and manage our integrity risk. So, as mentioned, I'm working with a team and we are on a mission to really prove the value of analytics to better manage this integrity risk. And I'll just reiterate what I mean by integrity risk, because that's been going to be a common theme that's coming out throughout the rest of my session. When we're talking about integrity risk, we're talking about quite a holistic view of not just fraud, but also waste and abuse, and how that impacts on the financial sustainability of schemes. So like all government entities, we are fully accountable to the public to make sure that our scheme is run with the utmost integrity. So on that note, I'll just reintroduce who the ACC is. We are the New Zealand Accident Compensation Corporation, which is the country's no-fault accident insurance scheme for all New Zealanders and all of its visitors. So we provide no-fault cover for all accidents, regardless of how or when they happen, so whether that be on the road, during work hours, at home. And we aim to prevent future injuries. We obviously compensate and we rehabilitate. In delivering these services, we spend around $6 billion a year. We receive around 2 million claims a year. And we spend around $1.6 billion on emergency treatment and travel. We spend around $1.3 billion on compensation and rehabilitation. And we spend around $55 million on our prevention messages. Another unique aspect about our scheme is we have this thing called our outstanding claims liability, where we fund for the lifetime of those injuries. So if someone injured their spine and they become a quadriplegic, we fund enough to cover the lifetime of all of their care and rehabilitation. That means we have around $36 billion funds under management right now, and that grows and reduces as our liability goes up and down. So integrity services have been at work, as I mentioned, with really proving the value of integrity around how analytics can transform the way we manage integrity risk. So I'll just very briefly sort of run through traditionally where we've come from. The sector really has focused reactively on responding to allegations in the field. So this low volume, low value approach normally nets us around $25 to $30 million a year. I say low value because around 50% of the time our investigations result in no further findings. So you could say 50% of the time we've wasted our energy, really. So how big is the integrity risk to entities like us, you might be thinking? Well, again, the industry estimates that up to 5% of annual turnover can be lost to fraud. And just to build on that, the top three industries that are hit hardest by fraud are the financial services, where we have a $36 billion interest, government, just due to its sheer size and complexity, and the third hardest hit industry is healthcare, where we spend $3 billion a year. And I'm sure the actuarial minds in the room can quickly calculate that 5% of $6 billion opens the door to quite a significant opportunity for improvement from our $25 to $30 million that we currently save. So the burning question is, how are we going to transform this integrity risk? And the answer is by taking a far more holistic and data-informed view of all the information available to us. So traditionally, we have sort of focused down here in the response area, but this is a prevention-led sort of framework where we aim to prevent fraud, waste and abuse from the outset, but the real essence of the framework is around data analytics and being data-informed. That then informs how we can better prevent, and it certainly drives how we're responding. So I will share some key takeouts from the experiences as we've been shifting from a low-volume, reactive approach to a high-volume, data-led framework. The other point that I touched on around why we're talking about fraud, waste and abuse is it enables us to have far more positive conversation with the business and the wider sort of community around preventing waste and abuse escalating into fraud. So the biggest financial cost to schemes like the ACC and many others over here is not actually in the fraud, it's actually in the waste and abuse. That's where schemes leak the most funds. And when we're talking about waste, typically we're talking about carelessness. That can be carelessness on the provider's part, the client's part, but more importantly, carelessness on our part, where we create an opportunity for someone to start exploiting us. That carelessness then evolves into abuse, where just by human nature, we start to organise our behaviours around activities that will maximise ourselves. This is where we get into overutilisation of services. It's also where we get into the grey fog of ambiguity, because technically, it's legitimate, it's okay, but it's here that can very quickly switch over into rationalisation, and then we're on a slippery slope down into fraud. I guess just to reiterate the key point from this slide, it's where integrity analytics and risk advisory can add the most value is in the waste and abuse, where we can prevent activities sort of escalating really into that fraud. So what have we done? Well, to be prevention-led, we set out to really prove the value of analytics to better manage integrity risk. So I'll very quickly take you through a structured methodology and take you through the proof of concept project that we had underway. So the first step was to really identify which tool met our predefined set of success criteria, and I'll come back to these. And we then very quickly started using a SaaS tool to help set up a virtual environment within ACC. Once we transferred all the data to this virtual environment on the SaaS tool, which is around 2 years of data, for the data enthusiasts out there, that's around 45 million rows of data, or 60 gigabyte of data. For the big picture people, that's around 4 million unique claims. We then defined and created scenarios. And again, I'll come back to this because it's a key learning that we also went through on this journey. We then generated violations using the tool to identify violations of the scenarios that we had just built. From that, we then generated the alerts and built networks. This was really how do we organise the data. We then generated a scoring model to self-prioritise where we should focus. So we allocated a risk score to each alert out of 1,000. And the scoring model was based on three elements. It was what's the potential dollar value at risk, what's the number of violations, and what's the severity, or how do these things build on each other. So what did we find? Well, we started off with 75 different scenarios where we really workshopped with the business, essentially how can we defraud the scheme. We then shortlisted based on ease of access to data points. And from there, 19 value-driven scenarios were deployed. I say value-driven because, again, we were in a time-pressured proof-of-concept phase. So we opted for simple business rules as opposed to the more advanced predictive analytics. This generated around 600,000 violations of those business rules. Now, we're not saying that's not 500,000 instances of fraud. That's just 500,000 instances which required further conversations with people. And again, taking a value-driven approach, we focused on the 11,000 provider alerts, which presented an opportunity spend of up to $130 million. To qualify this, the average alert score for a provider was around 75 out of 1,000. So on the whole, our natural distribution was well down at the it's okay end of the spectrum, which was really, really encouraging for us who had built these rules to say, okay, on the whole, providers seem to be doing the right thing. Let's focus on those who are not. So these critical success criteria I just mentioned. Safe to say we smashed all 8 of them, but there's 3 that I will really pull out. The first one is around return on investment. Now, there aren't many projects that have a 100% payback within the first 8-month period, and that's not even including the actuarial forecasted future savings. That's just on recoverables. Productivity improvements were similarly dramatic. Very shortly, I'll take us through a case study where we got more insights from 8 minutes from the data than we got from 8 months operating in the field. Lastly, increased visibility. Above all, the greatest success was how we could now have evidence-based conversations around waste and abuse. It became crystal clear that the scheme leaked the most funds through misinterpretation of legislation, what we put down to waste. These macro insights really enabled us to change the type of conversations we had with the business and the provider community. We could have far more positive conversations around prevention rather than more enforcement conversations around fraud. It really just changed the dynamics as to how we entered into this type of integrity conversation. To really help sort of unpack this, I'll take us through a very brief case study, and this is the one I just mentioned around 8 months versus the 8 minutes. So prior to us kicking this proof of value off, we had received a reactive referral about a physiotherapist. She told us someone had been providing services under her provider billing number, but she hadn't provided those services. So we initially started investigating this physiotherapist and her counterparts, and we did a manual sort of reconciliation into the bank account of all providers under that practice. There are three other physios and one podiatrist. So we investigated three other physios. I guess the point here is we lost several months before identifying the actual source of this investigation was the podiatrist. Coming to the end with the physios, we ended up contacting around 100 clients, and they all said they didn't receive any services from the physios. They'd only gone in to see the podiatrist. So, sorry, I didn't explain the graphs up there. They are my obligatory graphs for an actuary conference. I will very quickly explain, though. The blue graph is our podiatrist. Straight away, you can see he's well outside of the norm for his green vocation, his peer group, where he should have been. That first graph is around how much payment he received per month, and the next two graphs where he does rejoin his norms. The point where the blue and the green cross over initially, that's where we intervened and we had the conversation with him. Straight away, he stopped providing services under that provider ID number. I'll come to why he joined up with his peer group on my next slide. The other sort of key point I'd pull out around this operation was that this provider had been operating this way since 2013. We started looking at him because in 2015, someone reactively told us about it, let alone the thousands of others who were out there undetected without some sort of continuous control monitoring solution like we're now trialling. So, social network analysis. And I mentioned we got some extraordinary insights and we learned so much so quickly. It was really through the social network analysis. And I'm not talking about Twitter feeds or Facebook. This is really around linking data points like bank accounts, telephone numbers, addresses. Through creating these kind of connections, we start to get a network that emerges that has been previously unseen to the human eye. So Ray mentioned before that he rejoined his norm. What happened was he closed that practice down. He set up a new shell company with his children as the named directors, and those children who happened to reside at the same address as him suddenly formed in the social network analysis. This isn't his network, by the way. For privacy, we just have put up a dummy. But you can start to see how a picture emerges that, again, like I was saying, in the field, through reactive traditional investigation techniques, we just did not get these sort of insights. A investigation of this complexity, of this sort of level of fraud, takes far more than 12 months to really investigate to that nth degree. As I mentioned, the analysts working on this case got more value from 8 minutes with the data than they had got through 8 months through that traditional approach. So just to recap on what we've learnt, and before we move into question time, I hope the results of our proof of concept have really demonstrated how analytics has the potential to transform how we are managing our integrity risk. It is moving us from low-volume reactive response to more of a high-volume and proactive data-led framework. The scoring model helped us identify which alerts to focus on and prioritise, and the business rules we used were simple, but they were highly effective at starting and generating this conversation around better prevention of waste and abuse. And lastly, it also confirmed that the biggest loss and financial leakage was around the waste and abuse. So on that note, are there any questions?
What's ACC's next steps about taking it from the pilot to rolling it out across the organisation?
Great question. So we would love to deploy this straight away. Like all good things in government, things are not quite that simple. So ACC is going through quite a significant transformation program right now, and there's lots of contention on capital expenditure. So we are certainly in there, and we're continuing to reinforce the value that taking this more proactive, prevention-led approach can be far more effective than reactively waiting for. So that's sort of where we're trying to go right now.
I'm just wondering if you could explain a little bit more detail about the scenarios that you described, which were the fraud scenarios, and how you drew the connection back to waste.
Yeah, sure. So a lot of... So these 19 scenarios, they were a combination of business rules and outlier scenarios. So, for example, in a good outlier scenario is the blue line, the green line, right? Some more outlier scenarios where tell us where providers are billing us for more than 10 hours in a day. And where we do find providers who are billing us, say, 19 hours in a day, and we go to have those exploratory conversations, suddenly we find out that their interpretation of the regulations for healthcare for physiotherapies is that they can bill for a 60-minute block, can to include writing up their minutes, comes down to the definition of what isn't hands-on treatment. So we sort of chalk that up as, okay, so these people, this practice, genuinely believe that they can charge us for 19 hours in a 9-hour working day. It doesn't quite compute, but the way that they line up all of their physios and they charge us that way, it sort of was a great opportunity to really re-educate them on actually, you know, let's be sort of what's practical here.
Sure. Thanks, Dominic. Very interesting presentation. Quick question is, you talked about the 50% strike rate that you had previously. Obviously, this is going to be kind of a low-hanging fruit thing, but I'm wondering what was the interface between the analytics, which provides that triaging of potential fraud or waste, and then how much manual intervention goes on top of that, and have you actually gone far down that path yet to figure out that interaction?
Yeah, so great question, Alex. We really are in the space where by scoring these out of 1,000, they actually start to self-prioritise, right? So that provider who this one here, he had a risk score of 691 out of 1,000. He was pretty up there. Obviously, we focus on him over above the low and the medium. So in terms of the manual things we'll do over and above that, yeah, we'll still get our desktop, our Intel analyst to do some desktop sort of assessment to say, okay, so what else can we do here? But the beauty of this tool, of SaaS, is it enables drill down, right? So actually, again, going back to that productivity improvement I talked on, where Intel would spend up to 3-4 days amassing this traditional sort of report they would hand on the investigator, it's all there straight away for the investigator to dive right into. So actually, there's not too much more that's really needed.
I'd like you just to join with me in thanking Lisa and Dominic for two really interesting questions.